Mistakes along the Chicago way can kill you. So did we land the tuna? Alderman Edward Burke says on federal tape about a company he is allegedly trying to squeeze for their business. On federal tape. Did we land the tuna? Fantastic, Eddie. Fantastic. It's the thing that gets them. The thing that convicts Burke and other aldermen are their mouths and their pride. And our guest today knows it. She's a former federal prosecutor. She knows the Chicago way. She's been on this podcast several times when others in town didn't give her much of a chance. And she's just demanded Ed Burke resign from the Chicago City Council, where he's been for 50 years. Our guest's name, Mayor Lori Lightfoot. Burke's father was an alderman before him at 55th and Halsted in my old neighborhood. Years ago, aldermen were functionaries, laborers, petty grafters, tavern keepers, morticians, always reaching for an envelope full of cash, and the envelopes were greasy. But Burke was of the new breed. He went to law school. He didn't take those greasy envelopes full of cash. He took legal business, just like Mike Madigan, boss of Illinois. Burke would let the young alderman know how important a law degree can be. You know what a law degree is for a Chicago politician? It's a license to drive fast on the Chicago way. And Lightfoot, she's a lawyer too. After her years as a federal prosecutor, she came on board City Hall to help her friend Mary Dempsey clean up the rotten Department of Purchasing. For years, purchasing had been run by a guy I used to call the Mushroom. The department was full of scandal. The Duff brothers, tough friends of Mayor Daley with wise guys' connections, the same guys who asked me at Gene and Giorgetti's why my little boys didn't play in front of our house. They'd received $100 million in city contracts, and much of it minority contracts, even though the Duffs are as pink as Burke himself, as pink as an Easter ham. What amazed me is that federal prosecutors presented the case that City Hall was a victim of the Duffs instead of the enabler of the Duffs, with Rich Daley going to the Duffs' Christmas Eve parties at the old Como Inn and blowing off the Cardinals' own party year after year. Lightfoot and Dempsey took their job seriously, and they received serious pushback from insiders who wanted deals. They're around still. She was a deputy then, but she's mayor now. And it was the beginning of Lori Lightfoot's political education. With me, as always today, is my buddy and co-host, Jeff Carlin, the executive producer of WGN's Rokon Show with Anna DeVellantis. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and a member of its editorial board. Jason Meisner of the Tribune at the Federal Building will join us to talk about how the feds have landed Ed the Tuna Burke. And you know where you are right now. You're with Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
The Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
All right, joining us now is Jason Meisner, my friend, grill master, and also the Chicago Tribune's Federal Buildings court reporter. Hey, Jason.
Hey, how you doing?
How do you land a tuna?
That was one of the money quotes from the charges that came out yesterday against Alderman Burke. Did we land the tuna? Talking about one of the biggest development projects going on in Chicago right now, the old main post office building development.
Could you imagine hijinks around that massive piece of property? I'm as shocked, astounded even.
Yeah, there's a lot of money involved in that one, including $100 million in tax increment finance funding. And it's an $800 million project, massive building, lots of big companies going in. And I think, according to the allegations, Burke wanted a piece. He wanted to wet his beak, as they say.
And speaking of jargon and those who are trying to use tuna and euphemisms to get what they want and not get caught on tape, although they may have, can you set it up for us? Because we're going to talk to the mayor here in a second. But I really want to – there's a development this week as we tape this in this ongoing Burke process. And can you give us a quick recap on what that was?
Yeah, the government had until next week to file an indictment against Burke. He was charged originally in a criminal complaint in January. They asked for two extensions. So now yesterday, on Thursday, a week early, they filed their indictment. 59 pages. It's a included racketeering counts against Burke, against his longtime political aide, and against a developer named Charles Quay, who had previously been charged. So this indictment now really starts the legal process ticking. It had kind of been on hold. Burke had never been required to come in and enter a formal plea, which he's now going to be required to do on Tuesday. And from there, the criminal case gets going forward, and all the statutory and constitutional requirements kick in where, you know, he has a right to a speedy trial. There's going to be motions filed and all that business. So things start happening now.
And there could be more indictments coming, right? There's nothing that prevents the federal government from coming with more indictments.
No, and behind the scenes, everyone kind of expects that they filed this to get it on the record to get that process going. But nobody that I've talked to expects this to be the last indictment. They supersede indictments all the time. They did it in the Blagojevich case. They do it a lot in a lot of these big investigations, because as the government has said itself, the investigations are ongoing. There have been search warrants executed this month, just recently. There are certainly other avenues that they're investigating, and we expect more charges to come out.
So how many other aldermen might be snared in this? Right now we have two. We have Danny Solis, Alderman Nice Endings, likes the massage parlors and Asian women, and Alderman Ed Burke, who, according to federal tape, likes to fish and likes to land tunas. So how many more?
We don't know, of course, but we do know that Alderman Solis was wearing a wire at City Hall for, we believe, at least 2 years. So in this indictment, they kind of gave us a taste of some of the things he was recording, just with Burke. But, you know, you got some foul language on there. You got some references to Jewish lawyers. You have, and you can imagine, Solis was the chairman of a major committee involved in a lot of deals and was sitting with a lot of people. So we don't know how many aldermen, or if any, may be charged. Solis has not been charged. He hasn't been seen since this all came out that he was cooperating, and of course he's no longer on the council. But you know, it's not a stretch to imagine that there are a lot of people over at City Hall wondering what's going to come out next.
Speaking of what's come out so far, what's your favorite quote? I mean, I know I saw some of your tweets and some of the mentions in it, but what is the best piece of political corruption jargon and euphemism that you have you liked so far?
Well, the tuna quote has got to be one of the best ones since Blagojevich's famous "I got this thing and it's effing golden." Burke was talking to the Solis about the post office deal and getting the developers to hire his law firm. These are big time guys from New York who do a lot of buildings, including in Chicago, including the Prudential Building. That was their deal, the renovation of that building, multi-million dollar deal. So Burke says to Solis, did we land the tuna? Talking about getting them to hire his firm, because he knew there would be a lot of money there. There's also the one I led with, can't be ignored was when Burke was upset that they hadn't hired his firm yet, and they said, as far as I'm concerned, they can go F themselves, kind of showing where his mindset was.
Anybody else says that, well, then it's just a guy saying they should go F themselves. But if an alderman, chairman of the finance committee, who can put things on or off an agenda says that, you throw
that. He does say that at one point after the F themselves. Quote, he says, good luck getting that on the agenda, after Solis reminds him that, hey, these guys have big decisions that need to go through our committees here. And he says, well, good luck getting that on the agenda. So kind of a classic alleged use of his power there to deny them what they needed to get done at City Hall because they won't hire his firm.
I can just imagine the lawyers looking at the jury after turning smartly in their nice suit, looking at the jury and giving them a wink after they repeat that one. Last question.
Imagine this quote up like on a big screen in like 4 foot high letters where he says the cash register hasn't rung yet. That's another good one,
dude. Classic.
Now if you're the all these out-of-town business people or in-town business people who've been meeting with developers who have gone before the zoning committee, they've got, you know, we've been focusing on the aldermen, but we haven't even lit up the business community. They've got to be freaking out. No?
I would think so. Especially if we know that Burke's phone was wiretapped. They include some of what they were listening in on is on Burke's phone, but it's mostly what's in this indictment is mostly what Solis recorded. So they haven't, I'm thinking about it, they haven't really gotten to the taps on Burke's phone except in one of the four schemes. And of course, she must have been talking to, we know, a lot of developers. The developers in this so far have been portrayed by the government as victims. They were being shaken down. And in some cases, like the post office deal, these guys are from New York, and they were kind of stringing them along. They weren't doing what Burke wanted.
So. Oh, the poor little virgins that they are.
So far, they're being portrayed as victims.
Yeah, it reminds me.
They released a statement yesterday saying, you know, we're the victims here, and we didn't pay them any money, and we didn't want to. And so no charges against this company, this post office developer, but we'll see what comes down going forward.
It reminds me, Jason, of when the Duffs cleared $100 million out of City Hall by saying they were minorities, even though they were pink as hams, and Rich Daley used to go hang out with them at the Como Inn at their Christmas parties, but the way when it came out in the federal court, it was like City Hall was a victim of these nefarious schemers.
Perfect.
And then Jimmy Duff takes a blind plea 10 years, see you later.
Wasn't it on the day it was supposed to go to trial or right before the trial, a blind plea?
Two blind pleas I've seen, Jason. Bill Hanhart, chief of detectives for Joey Lombardo in the Chicago Police Department, and Jimmy Duff. Blind plea, no deal, I'm going to prison, see you later, and see you in 10 years. Amazing. Jason Weisner, Chicago Tribune, barbecue master, dad, and loving husband to Elizabeth. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks a lot, John.
Ain't no love in the heart of the city. Ain't no love.
Now we're with a guest who's been here before, and I remember she was here talking about Ed Burke and how when he was arrested, or let's say when the feds raided his office, she likened it to a meteor.
Yeah.
And how it hit the campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think at that time, given that it was Burke, first of all, when I started hearing the rumors before it hit, I thought, there's no way. This guy has been in the game too long. He's been too smart. But what we saw in that initial criminal complaint affidavit was that he was sloppy. He's using his phone that everybody knows. He's sitting and scheming with, now we know, Andrews. And then what we see in the superseding indictment that came down yesterday was a course of dealing over many years where there was a comfort level that he clearly had in engaging in what is alleged to be criminal conduct. And if the allegations are right, it's clearly criminal conduct. So that's part of it. But what animated me in particular and why I believe that it was appropriate for me to call on him to resign is seeing the way in which he manipulated the tools of government, people at all levels, to try to bend his will, hopefully unwittingly, to help him facilitate a criminal enterprise focused on enriching himself at the expense of the public.
So you think that Burke should resign?
I absolutely do.
Why?
For the reasons I just said, which is, this isn't, I actually chatted with some of my former AUSA buddies in the last few hours, trying to remember it from Silver Shovel, which was the last big investigation that involved the city council, if we'd seen anything like this superseding indictment, meaning multiple criminal activity, different schemes, multiple years, using the tools of city government to help facilitate it. This wasn't some dude in a diner taking a bag of money, right?
Right.
Doing a single shakedown, as we saw a lot of the aldermen
leave
that were convicted.
Leave it in the envelope, right?
Yeah, right, right.
The envelope.
Absolutely. This is something, a degree different. It is using city government as a criminal enterprise to facilitate and enrich himself. That's different. And I just don't see how, given that these allegations, I think, undermine any notion of integrity, legitimacy, that he's lost some moral authority that you have to have in order to be a public servant.
What have you asked your people, your administration, corporation counsel, to do specifically as a result of this superseding indictment?
Well, what I'm asking them to do is to scrub the superseding indictment, to identify any current employees or current city vendors who are identified in the indictment. Now, nobody's identified by name, but I think there's some obvious ways in which we can figure this out, to determine what role, if any, they played in wittingly or unwittingly facilitating criminal conduct.
Isn't that, I mean, I grew up, as you may know, in a small family business out there in the 14th Ward.
Mm-hmm.
We had the inspectors come. They liked steaks. I had to give them steaks. But even larger than that is the use of government as the hammer. In other words, it's the mafia 100%. used as a gun. They used government, which I think is even adds to the cynicism. Does it not?
No, I think it's absolutely, totally repugnant to any notions of public service. You know, somebody asked me, well, you know, the voters knew this and they voted for him anyway. No, the voters didn't know the scope and magnitude of the charges that were set forth yesterday. And I can't predict what the outcome would have been, but, you know, he had two opponents, and had he been indicted with this breadth of alleged criminal conduct, there's no question that that would have had an impact on the election.
When you ask your government to go and go through and find the vendors, people should know that you were former deputy purchasing agent of the city of Chicago. You were brought in to work with Mary Dempsey, a colleague of yours,
yep,
a friend, to clean something up that Al the Mushroom Grib and others, when you were in the federal building, had allowed to go run rampant.
Yeah.
So you started looking at contracts, the way I get it, and cleaning up the process.
Mm-hmm.
And as you did so, I call it the first steps of your political education in the Chicago way, even though you were a prosecutor and understood it from that side. Now you were in city government.
Mm-hmm.
And you got pushback from people with power and connections with the mayor of Chicago.
That's right.
How did that feel?
Well, initially, when we started, and the pushback came in part because we were asking people to play by the same rules, not special rules for donors, not special rules for friends. And initially, didn't matter. Then when we started getting the calls from the fifth floor, when we were trying to do our job, and this was not a job I volunteered for. It was a job that I was asked to do. And don't ask a former federal prosecutor to clean something up if you don't want me to do my job.
Because
I'm
going to
do it.
Cover it up. I meant clean it up when I said that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, my North Star is very clear, always has been. The only thing you have in life is your integrity. So I did my job. Some people didn't like it. There are people that I see now from those days who literally turn and go in the other direction every time they see me. But, you know, you got to do the right thing. You know, I was there over the course of that summer when the FBI came in and did another search warrant of the Interagovernment Affairs Office.
Tim Degnan?
No, this is the Hired Truck.
This was his protege, Victor, Whispering Victor Reyes.
Yeah. So the heat was turned up, you know, to boiling point that summer. But, you know, we kept trying to do everything that we knew was right. And I took away from that experience why it's important for leaders to stand up and stand for integrity. You know, somebody asked me today at the press conference, well, what gives you the right? I said, I'm the mayor of the city. If I have to stand for moral integrity, and it's incumbent upon me, given who I am, given the mandate that I received from the voters, to call it as I see it. It is absolutely untenable to have somebody who has weaponized the instruments of government for his own behalf against public and private interest to remain as an alderman.
One of my, I guess, I lament the federal authority, not the FBI as much as the U.S. Attorney's Office. I know they want to have everything dotted and they want to win every case. And they're cautious by nature and training. But I've always wondered, isn't that the essence of the Chicago Way, weaponized government for profit? Remember when we were talking back when Preckwinkle was the big cheese and people weren't giving you the time of day and you were thinking, well, is this going to happen for me? And you said, government's not about pirate booty.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I just think we have to keep showing people that they have a right to expect something different from elected officials and that government can and should be different, which is why I've urged John Lausch, the U.S. attorney, who I have a lot of respect for, and I think he's doing great work, particularly in helping us address our violence issues. But I've said to him, this isn't like a drug case. This isn't like a mafia case. It is absolutely untenable if they know that public officials have and continue to commit crimes, pull the plug as quickly as possible. Bring that to light.
Not many people, not many mayors or political figures would tell the U.S. attorney fish or cut bait, but you did, and you are a former prosecutor. That seemed, I talked to many of my colleagues, particularly those I respect, like Jason Meisner at the federal building, and he said, wow, that was kind of bold.
You know, bold or not, you know, I look at just this case, and my information is that this is one of many that are out there. We know that this has been going on, at least this investigation has been going on at least since 2016, as revealed in the superseding indictment. My information is that it started at least several years before that.
Right. They may have had another focus at the time it started.
Yes. And to have an elected official like Danny Solis walking around wearing a wire for 2 years. I said to somebody, you're old enough to remember those Shell no pest strips, right? This is like this guy is just hanging out there, and any fly, insect, mosquito that, you know, comes near gets stuck. So they've got to have a huge body of evidence.
How many thousands of hours of phone conversations?
Yeah, well, I think what we saw in the superseding indictment, like 9,800 calls, something like that. That's one subject. That's one phone.
Burke, 9,800 calls on the phone.
I think that's right. Over many years,
that he would do the phone thing is astounding.
That's why. I mean, his own words are going to be the thing that are going to hang him.
As a former federal prosecutor, when you hear on the witness, you know, you hear the tape before the indictment, you hear have we landed the tuna yet, or whatever he said. What is, or you hear, I love Masat, not me, not John Cass. I'm happily married to my lovely Sicilian. But if an alderman saying, I love massage parlors and really Asian girls, when you hear that as a prosecutor, yeah. What do you get? Do you feel like, you don't smoke, do you?
Mm-mm.
But do you ever feel like having a cigarette when you hear that? Like, this is just too good.
Well, look, landing the tuna is something right out of Tony Soprano, right?
Right.
You can hear that coming out of his mouth. And, you know, the other stuff regarding the massage parlors, you know, I think about what did he tell his daughters? What did he tell his daughters? What did he tell his wife? Right? I mean, that's the point, right? Is these people feel like they're invincible,
right?
That they can do whatever they want, that they amass this power and they're invincible and they can exercise power and demands just because. Well, not so fast.
Back in the day when you were coming onto the city hall to help Mary Dempsey clean up abuses in the Department of Purchasing, you questioned the relationship between City Hall and Eastlake Management.
Yes.
And its principal, Elsie, I Love Rich Daily, Higginbottom, who is now, I think, now an investor, a big-time publisher of...
Sometimes, The Reader.
Right, and that's, isn't it perfect? The Reader, in the intersectional highways, I call it. What do you make of it now? What do you see? Do you see Elsie? Do you see him? Does he say, hi, Mayor, I'm really sorry that I called Rich and complained about you?
I haven't gotten that apology. I do see him from time to time, but usually across the room. And usually when we make eye contact, he goes in a different direction.
Wow.
But he's still around.
Yeah, he's still
around. Got a lot of city contracts, both in the city and the Chicago Housing Authority.
Wow. If Elsie, if you just heard that, I think you should sit down and have a drink. If I have a concern, is that somebody says Elsie Higginbottom, you know who he is.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody says the Duffs, you know who they were
mm-hmm.
and are, right?
Right.
But I wonder if enough of your staff, and they're young people, and they're aggressive, and they believe in you, do you have enough of the people? I've argued publicly, so it's not anything you don't know, that what I'm concerned about is you need more people around you who know where these bodies are buried.
Yeah.
Am I off base?
No, I think that's a fair point. I've actually been thinking about what Chicago history book I could give my team to read to make sure that they're kind of up to speed on these issues. Because, yeah, I do have a lot of young people around me, but I also have a lot of people who, and young and, you know, my age, who have a lot of street smarts and common sense and... you know, they believe the same things I believe, which is government should be fundamentally about serving people. It's got to be open and transparent. And I've got a lot of former federal prosecutors around me as well that we brought into government. And they get it. They get it. And they get why we have to operate in a very different way. Now, the challenge is going to be making sure that that ethos gets instilled in the departments and goes down. The challenge also obviously is how do I manage relationships with the city council that has been used to a different kind of governance, a different kind of mayor. You know, I got some complaints that I was too harsh on Ed Burke
and city council. I saw one of the other ones slouching in his chair on council day. Anthony Beale, he was pouting, you know, chairmanless, publicly chairmanless is what someone wrote. Okay, I hate quoting myself, but it was apt. Yeah, some people don't like it, but, you know, what do I can't. What can I tell them? What do you tell them?
I tell them it's a new day. And, you know, with respect to Beale, I can put up with a lot of things. I got a thick skin. I've seen a lot. But the one thing I'm never going to put up with is somebody who lies to me repeatedly and who uses my name to try to enrich themselves.
Try to use your name in what capacity?
Carve up the spoils of city council. And when I confronted him, he lied and said he wasn't doing it. And I'm like, then why are so many of your colleagues calling me uncomfortable that they were even in the room while you were making representations about me. So, look, people choose the way in which they want to conduct themselves in public life. And no one's going to be perfect, and I certainly am not. I'm going to certainly make mistakes. But I expect that people are going to try to do the right thing and operate in a way that does have integrity, that isn't about stuffing money in their pockets. I'm thinking of, what was his name, Medrano?
Yeah.
Who's caught on tape, and he's stuffing the money in his pockets. Can you see this? And then says, I work for you, because he was completely and utterly for sale. These are different differences, but on the same spectrum.
A two-time loser.
Yeah.
And that was the same ward that Danny Solis comes from.
Yes, that's right.
And it extends, it used to extend east, almost to the edge of Chinatown.
Mm.
Just saying.
Like the reference.
Yeah.
So fly day, Chinatown.
Mayor, thanks again for coming in. I tell you, in the last 8 years of your predecessor, I probably threw out a couple hundred, 300-400 requests to have him come in and to various guests and talk and be on air with people I was producing for, including John and other stations. And not once did they'd ever make time for us. There was always something. So I commend you for that and for being able to be here and making time for us.
No, it's my pleasure.
I got to say, the thing that I know is the toughest thing that gets hung around you is probably the violence in the city. Because it really, as much as we want to believe that a new mayor can come in and ride a wave of happiness and sunshine and fix that thing, it's a huge problem that has so many layers to it. And clearly you're about changing the business in City Hall and making it so that it's working for us, which I can't tell you how much I want that to happen. Do you fear that moving forward, you're going to be split between making the city, continuing to grow the city as an international hub and making it an economic powerhouse, and trying to fix all the big problems that are tied to graft and the Burks of the world? Do you think that you're going to ever come to a time where you're going to have to choose, well, am I going to keep on the path here, or am I going to have to go down this path to try to push Chicago forward?
No, to me, they're all part of the same ecosystem. You know, I just look at the level of violence that we've had this week. I now get notifications about shots fired, people who have been injured, people who have been killed. My inbox is full all day long, all night long. That is utterly unacceptable. So what we've now said to the police department is we're going to be having accountability Mondays. So we've set a standard where certain level of shots, anyone who has been seriously injured or killed and any disturbances downtown, they're going to come see me, and I'm going to ask hard questions. I need to understand that every single member of the police department, and particularly the quote-unquote bosses, have a sense of urgency, that they can't sleep at night because they are worried about what more they can do to stem the tide of violence. Now, I hasten to add, this isn't all on the police department. We got a serious lack of investment in neighborhoods where the illegal drug trade is the largest employer. I'm not naive to that. But the men and women of the police department, and particularly the leadership, better wake up every day with a sense of urgency that they've got to do something different and better to stem the violence. This is not business as usual. This is not going to be the new norm in our city. And I've sent that message, I thought, loud and clear, but clearly not loud enough. So that's why we're going to have Accountability Mondays.
And we were lucky enough to have the superintendent in a couple weeks ago. And one of the things I threw out to him is that, you know, as someone who works downtown but lives up on the north side and works, you know, I mean, in that quasi-millennial demographic, a lot of my coworkers and friends and people I know, they take the red line every day.
Yeah.
And it's the Wild West. I mean, I can't tell you a train trip I've taken where there isn't someone coming through the train trying to sell weed, or there isn't someone trying to sell something else, or smoking a joint on the train, or pushing somebody out of the way, or cursing, or just being mean, or being you know, just the evil you see every day. And it seems like it's completely rampant. And I've got friends. I've got a friend here who's former Marine, 6'2", 300 pounds, could bench press this entire studio. And he's afraid to take the red line because, one, he knows if something happens, his right. bound by his moral duty right. to intervene.
Right.
I wonder, well, is that out of focus?
I got to tell you, that's very, very distressing to hear. And I have a great deal of respect for Dorval Carter, but you can be sure that when we end here today, I'm going to be calling him. Now, look, they depend upon the police department to provide security. They have some other additional security assets that they use. But Wild Wild West is not something that's going to be acceptable on any train line, any bus. And I've seen some things that are happening, and I think to myself, we cannot just act like, what can you do? This is just how it is. No, it's not how it is, and it's not how it's going to be. And we have to do a far better job in establishing norms of decency. People should be able to enjoy the city without feeling like they're under siege. And I hadn't heard this about the Red Line, but you can be sure we will take care of that, and there'll be a difference that's made.
When you have these accountability Mondays, I just want to be clear in my head. Are you going to cross-examine police officers who've been involved in shootings yourself?
Well, what I'm going to do is bring in the bosses and ask them tough questions. We had a session on Tuesday where there were a couple things that happened over the weekend that I was supremely unhappy about, and there's got to be accountability. It's not my intent or interest to micromanage the police department. I'm not a crime fighter, right? That's not my job. But my job is to make sure that people are doing theirs and to hold them accountable. And, you know, they go through CompStat occasionally, I think not frequently enough. But we're gonna ask tough questions. I'm going to be armed with information about what's happened, where the problem spots are. And I want to make sure that they're doing their jobs and that they get the message that I'm paying attention and that they can't, I'll use a different word than what I would use ordinarily, but they can't buffalo me. They can't act like I'm some naive civilian who doesn't get it. I get it. And I'm going to hold them accountable.
So where's the information coming that you're going to use to hold them accountable? The same people that you're going to ask questions?
Well, no. I'm getting the data analytics on a regular basis. I've asked for information to be reported out. I mean, you know, if worse comes to worse, I'm going to, hey, jackass, and looking at those guys who I think actually do a really good job and they have accurate information. But the data is the data. What we're doing with it, how we're acting on the intelligence that we're getting. But, you know, I think we've had an outrageous number of shootings this week. We have a bunch of homicides. What is happening? What are they doing? How are they adjusting the strategy and the assumptions to deal with these issues? And are they doing that effectively? As I said, there's got to be a sense of urgency.
Someday the honeymoon will end, and you're going to be faced with the things you know you're facing already.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be faced with a budget.
Yep.
You're going to be faced with the FOP contract.
FOP, CTU, finances.
And you're going to be faced with finances. We had this talk, right, out on the street once a few weeks ago before you were mayor. Did Rahm Emanuel give you, it looked like there was like a $400 million difference or 200, something like that, some huge amount of difference in what's owed. How do you deal with all that?
Well, I'm waiting for the legislative session to be over to see what, if any, resources we're able to generate from there. And we've been monitoring the back and forth a lot to see, and we've been not just monitoring, but we've been actively engaged in discussions with the leadership and with the governor's office to see what help we can get from Springfield. But I also think that it's important for me to be very transparent about the magnitude of the challenge. So sometime soon, I will go before the public and lay it out.
And tell them that they're going to have to pay more.
Well, look, what I'm hoping is that we come up with a series of solutions that are going to be the least painful. But I would be lying if I didn't say that we're going to have a conversation about revenue. The size of the hole
is
huge. Huge.
It's almost as if I've heard people say, why don't we just go into receivership?
You know,
you've heard that too.
Yeah,
right?
I've heard that too. And a couple years back, I attended a program where the lawyer who was the bankruptcy trustee for the city of Detroit through its bankruptcy was asked that question. And I think he said, and I believe it's true, we're very different than Detroit. Look, bankruptcy would be catastrophic for the city. Let me be clear about that. We also have a diverse and robust economy that Detroit didn't have. Detroit was almost 100% dependent upon the auto industry, yeah, which was tanking. But we do have our challenges. I don't want to come to the public talking about, woe is me, this is how bad it is, without coming to the public at the same time with a series of prescriptions that we're going to try to implement to solve the problem, not just for next year, but structurally. That's the thing that we've been pushing a lot on in talking to folks in Springfield. I'm not sure that we're going to get there in this session, just because the kind of things that we're talking about, you know, lasting structural changes are something that's a multi-year conversation.
So is receivership part of that equation?
No, it really isn't.
That's
not.
To be clear,
yeah, that would be clear. That is not something that we're thinking about. I don't think we need to go down that path. But the challenges are great. There's no question about it.
There's also political challenges, and you're the mayor, and that's a political job as well.
Mm-hmm.
Chicago is losing people,
losing population, right.
Population, and we're going to have Chicago will have to come to grips with, say, a loss of a congressional seat.
At least one.
Correct. Now, how I know, last time I checked, Bobby Rush, who's strong in the 19th Ward, I think his theme song is from the Dropkick Murphys, right? His campaign theme. He's worried about it and has, you know, rounded on you and played the race card. I don't get it, but he did it. And where do you see this thing going with congressional spots? And where are you going to be?
Well, look, I'm going to call balls and strikes. I've said to you before, and I've said repeatedly, that the loss of population ought to be the proverbial canary in the mine shaft. We should be deeply alarmed by it. I think there's a couple things that we have to do immediately, which is make sure that we're ready for the census and that we get everybody counted. I mean, everybody counted. We've got to scour every neighborhood. We've got to put a lot of resources in making sure that we get the count right. I think Senator Durbin shared that his estimates are every person lost is $1,800 a year over 10 years, $1,800. Do the math, span it out by tens of thousands. That's a significant loss of resources to the city and to the state. So we've got to deal with that. Look, and we also have to just be honest about the reasons why people are leaving. They're leaving because of the violence. They're leaving because of the schools. They're leaving because of the lack of economic opportunity. And the people that are leaving, interestingly, are low-income, working-class Black folks. Those are the people that are leaving. The South Side in particular has been decimated by population loss, and it has a ripple effect across everything, including what's happening in our schools. So we have to better understand why that is. I mean, again, I think some of the reasons are obvious, and do everything we can to build back the neighborhoods that have been depleted by population loss.
Is there anything you'd want to leave us with? I noticed in your news conference you talked about, you defined the Chicago way. What is the, how do you define it?
Well, I think of the Chicago way as this notion that you have to give to get, that it's understood that in order to actually get access to basic city resources and services, you got to go through this kabuki dance with aldermen, kiss the ring, make the donation, on and on, and hire the kid, on and on and on. That's the old Chicago way. I think the new Chicago way that I'm trying to forge is one where if you're a resident and you're a taxpayer, you're entitled to great services everywhere. No matter where you live, no matter your zip code, no matter who you know, you don't have to go through these extra steps to be able to get access to basic city services. And I think this is a lesson from the Burke indictment, that city workers are actually able to do their jobs without worrying about political backlash because they haven't pleased the local fiefdom and the local alderman. That's the city that I aspire to. And I think we can get there. It's going to take time, but I think we can get there.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask, do you think, do we see the prospect of the Obama Library coming and happening in Chicago soon?
Well, it's not a library.
Well,
it's a but no, that's an important distinction. It's a presidential center. There's obviously things that have to get resolved. I'm looking forward to getting up to speed from, I'll call it both sides, but there's lots of different interests. I want to get this resolved so that we can move forward. It's an honor for the center to be here, make no mistake about it. But we have to also be respectful of the people in the neighborhoods who are going to be affected and are worried about displacement. They're worried about jobs. They're worried about the impact on everything from infrastructure to traffic, and rightfully so. And we've got to be respectful of the hard work that they've done, and people should have a right to be able to stay in their neighborhood. You know, on the casino question, people ask me all the time, where should it be? I'm never going to say that. Right, because the land speculation is going to go through the roof, and that's exactly what happened with the presidential center. And there was no real plan to address that, and we've got to fix it. I'm, you know, several years after the fact, but we're going to fix it, and we're going to make it right for people in those neighborhoods.
There was a landmine that you basically almost touched with your big toe, but then you, right?
You know,
interesting.
I thank you for that too, because throw this out there. There was a question the other day thrown at you about the McPeer tax.
Yeah, the tax.
And the question was thrown at you. It just kind of popped up, and you're like, I don't have enough information. I can't give you a good answer. And I got to tell you, as a citizen, how refreshing that is, because I can't tell you how many aldermen just on the street I've talked to or thrown a question at, and I get some spiel about hearts and minds and children and schools and completely
puppies and babies.
Exactly.
Right.
And I want to hear more of that. I want to hear, you know what? I don't know about it. I'm going to look into it. We'll get you an answer.
Jeff, the thing is, why should Mr. D. Shish Kebabs on the northwest side pay that extra tax? But I'm going to leave that up to Mayor Lightfoot and her staff.
Yeah, well, more on that later.
Mayor Lori Lightfoot, thanks for being here. I hope you come back. And
definitely will.
We've got a lot more to ask you, but we're going to let you go now. Thank you.
Thanks
for being
guys.
There. That was a tour on the Chicago Way with Mayor Lori Lightfoot. And if I were some of the people she talked about, Elsie Higginbottom, investor of the Sun-Times, I'd think about that, what she had to say, and how she said it. For Jeff Carlin, WGN producer of The Rokan Show with Anna DeVellantis, and for Jason Meisner, the Chicago Tribune's federal beat reporter, who knows all about indictments and how tunas are landed. And for Lori Lightfoot, mayor of Chicago. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, syndicated columnist of the Chicago Tribune, member of the Tribune's editorial board. You've been on the Chicago Way on WGN+.